Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Oh come, Emmanuel. And ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here, until the Son of God appears. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel.
Our reading this morning, as we begin this season of Advent together, all of the readings over these 4 weeks are going to come to us from the Gospel of Matthew. And we start towards the end of the Gospel of Matthew, and I'm going to read from chapter 24, beginning at verses 36, and you're welcome to follow along on the screen if you'd like. But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day our Lord is coming. But understand this: if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour.
They will be surprised when they hear him say, take me to the alley, take me to the afflicted ones, take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear me say, I am your friend. Come to my table, rest here in my garden. You'll have a pardon.
Matt's the one that creates these phenomenal screens for us. And I only gave him two pictures for this morning, which is a little hard to imagine. But I felt that there's so much around here this first day for all of us to take in. There's a lot to look at. There's a lot to wonder about. And I think that while we may not understand everything all at once, I'm going to encourage everyone to wait for that understanding. And that's what we do in Advent, is wait. A friend of mine, who I've known for a very long time, we met when I was taller than him. He's 6'4" and a half. He was the first person really to say it to me in this way, and he's known for saying it. Wait for it. We'll be somewhere. Wait for it. He is a very wise man, one of the wisest I know. He is an Order of the Arrow Eagle Scout. Now, that doesn't mean a lot to people. Have heard of Eagle Scout. Raise your hand if you've heard of an Order of the Arrow. Anyone? Oh, okay. So an Order of the Arrow is a rare bird, which is a scout that is voted on by his peers and older to be part of this order. It means you are always prepared. Like, scouts are supposed to be prepared, but Order of the Arrow Scouts, that's who you want to be with on a deserted island. He wasn't always an Order of the Arrow Eagle Scout, though, because he, too, had to wait for it, right? He worked his way up the ranks. That's how long I've known him. 40 years later, after joining Scouts, Troop 6 in Berkeley, he is now the Scoutmaster. It's a great honor. It's an honor because it's Scoutmaster of the same troop that he joined as a boy. And we've remained friends over the years, and there have been many opportunities, as you can imagine, for him to remind me that I have to wait for it. He and I ran a summer camp together, and he was my firemaster. And that's a very important position, because you have campfire every night, right? I want you all to imagine the hugest pile of wood that you can imagine, but it's very artfully put together. It is not just a lump. It is artfully put together, and he would light one match. And to make a point of it, he would only bring one match. And we were like, holy crap, Mike, really? He'd light one match, and he'd say, wait for it and watch. And he'd disappear into the fire, and you'd see nothing. We'd hold our breath, and then little by little, you saw the flame start to flicker. It would grow slowly, and his personal goal, which he would whisper only the adults knew, was to see how long it took for the first row of kids to have to move back, because it was that hot. Wait for it and watch, he would say, and then we'd watch the kids one by one move. Last June, I think a lot of us know, but Matt and I got a grant to write, and June was my month to do some writing, and I was in the Napa Valley to do that, and my friend Mike was nearby. We met often because his mother was in the hospital there. It was the last days of her life, and it was my turn to say to him, wait for it and watch. As she transitioned and we sat by her bed, and she moved from death into the beyond. It was difficult, as you can tell. And it was really sad. But we were together. We've been together a long time. And afterwards, the funeral, you know, happened. And we went to the cemetery. And then we went out to the house. We broke bread and we told stories. And mostly we just sat together. And he said, what's it going to be like? I said, I don't know. Wait for it. So we're living now, all of us, into this advent of a new time, he and I and his family, in which his mother is going to be with us in a new way. We watch together for signs of her. And you don't know this, but this room is actually a sign for her, of her. She was totally, I'll be fine, just my mentor in creative worship. And I could hear her say, oh, Linda, for Advent, you just don't want to stand up there and talk about an alley. You need to take them to the alley. And she did not create this. Jan and Melissa and Eric did. But she was my mentor to say, do it. That's what Gregory Porter's mom, Ruth Porter, also said and did for him. She said, do it, and she took him to an alley, to the alley. And I think you can already pick it up in this song and others we've done. There's a tender sadness that's shaped the words that Gregory Porter sings. He's a really giant man with a deep, rich voice who has suddenly become this favorite jazz singer around. And he is performing in large part only because of the words that his mom spoke as he waited and watched at her bedside as she lay dying from breast cancer. This is a quote from him. She was literally on her deathbed, he said. She'd been sent home to be with her family. She was connected up to the oxygen, but still she could hardly breathe. But she found the strength to tell me that I should try and become a professional singer. Something he had never expected for himself or even dared to consider until she said that to him. He says, I just didn't see how it could work. It took a while for it to come to him. He had to wait and watch for the words and the music to be born in him. See, that's what happens in Advent. You wait and watch for the morning to be in us. Advent's the time when the church calendar calls us to wait and watch for this new beginning to be born. A beginning that's ushered in with the birth of God into the world through the life of an unwed teenage girl in an unadorned, rudimentary, at best, birthing room, which would never pass muster today, full of animals. And while the world will wait for a new beginning as we usher in 2017, you know, January 1, we begin the new year today. Advent is a time of waiting and of keeping watch for God, for Emmanuel, which means God with us. If you heard the first verse of the scripture that Matt read for us this morning from the Gospel of Matthew, it focuses on the second coming of Christ. It's a reminder that the first coming of Christ in Jesus, it's not complete yet. Matthew's gospel wants the followers of Jesus, though, to be prepared to witness to our experience of good news all the time and to join God in building and creating God's kingdom of heaven on earth all the time. And Matthew's gospel has this unique style, which has been and still is interpreted many ways by lots of Christians. It's a style we call apocalyptic. In other words, it anticipates the end of things. It's a word that anticipates and means the end of time, maybe. A time when a veil between what is real and what is in the future will become transparent for us. A thin place is what it'll become. And it's a way and a moment in which God's heaven is revealed here on earth. Advent is a season of waiting and watching for that very moment. And some followers of Jesus throughout history have used this text in a kind of scary way to predict the world's end. You know, you've heard that word rapture. I just want to remind people that's not part of the Bible. It's not in the Bible. It's not there. And it won't come as a surprise to us to note that there are plenty of Christians, I think, who want to provide easy answers to difficult, hard questions by pointing to some made-up thing called the rapture. Truth is, it can actually be quite complex. In an interview in the Christian Century a few years back, there is a scholar, Barbara Rossing, and she has written a book to tease apart some of the details. And her book is called The Rapture Exposed. And they asked her, how then should Christians talk about apocalypse and apocalyptic literature? And she responded by saying something that makes sense to me. She says, well, we can ask where apocalyptic moments are happening today and how such experiences transform us, since apocalypses are also about transformation. At the time that she was writing this book and being interviewed, she was actually talking about Hurricane Katrina. And she was saying that that was a kind of apocalypse, noting that that natural disaster and event pulled back a veil and showed us something that maybe we hadn't been able to see. See, that's the root of the meaning of the word apocalypse, is pulling back a curtain to expose something that keeps us normally from seeing the difference between reality and the future. Then it was Katrina. Today, it's an election, I think, that exposes things that many have known for a really long time and others do not want to acknowledge or speak of. Still, other followers of Jesus have used this very text that Matt read to encourage folks to stay prepared. That seems reasonable. It makes sense if we keep in mind that the early Christians to whom the Gospel of Matthew was written were in the first century, like roughly 90 years after the events he is describing took place. And those early Christians have been expecting the second coming for quite some time. In fact, some scholars think that the Gospels themselves, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were all written in part to encourage Christians who were like confused and discouraged by Jesus' delayed return. I gotta take this off, sorry. This is likely why Matthew, like the writers of Mark and Luke, all encourage all of the beloved community to stay awake and be prepared. One of the scholars I read this week said it like this: if they aren't watching and waiting, Matthew suggests, they very well may miss God's advent among them when Jesus comes a second time. Well, nearly 2,000 years have passed, right? We're still waiting. So our reading of this has to shift to understanding apocalyptic texts in symbolic or figurative ways as reminders of God's continual luring of us towards peace with justice. This is probably wise, since waiting for it doesn't really seem to be humanity's strongest skill. As I said, some long for easy answers to hard questions. Our version of losing focus is, I think, racing from Thanksgiving table to stand in line for shopping. We can't even wait until Friday. We can't definitely not wait till small business, whatever that was, Saturday, and Cyber Monday. They all got names. I think it's Cyber Tuesday, actually. We want, yeah? Giving Tuesday, excuse me. Wait for it. That's what our job is, to wait for it and watch. But if we're going to wait for it and watch, where are we supposed to look? What direction? The first reading in Advent invites us actually to look in two directions, back in the birth narrative and forward to the second coming. There's a tension there. How can you look two ways at once? If we're waiting for angels and shepherds in the fields, wise ones bearing gifts and heavenly choruses, they're not here this week. They're not here next week either. We're going to have to wait for it. Dang. Because what we hear this morning is a reminder of the flood. A flood that covered the earth and took all of creation with it, except for those that Noah managed to get on the ark, thank goodness. And then we hear of those who are caught by surprise, right? He read about those that are not ready. Two who are in the field, one's going to get taken. one will be left. Two are grinding flour, one will be taken, one will be left. It said, but about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only God. At the end of the passage, Jesus underscores it again. God will come at an unexpected hour. So you must also be ready, because the Son of Man will come in an hour when you do not expect him. No one will know when the Lord will come, not even Jesus. So how do we go about letting go of that, like, image of an event, a moment of Jesus' eventual return? How do we do that? Well, I think on one level, we just let it go and let that solve itself and lean in instead to something else that feels really real to me, maybe for you too. It's, what is it like to live in these uncertain times when you really don't know when something is going to happen? I think that's something we know about. If I were writing the Bible, which nobody asked me to do, but if I were, this is how I would have said it. You know, I hear it more like this. Two colleagues apply for a prestigious cohort. One is chosen, the other's not. We know what that feels like. Two neighbors are raising their families side by side. One gets diagnosed with cancer, the other not. All good. Two kids are working their way through high school. One becomes an addict, the other not. Don't know why. Two couples get married the same year. One stays married, the other not. You see, our lives are filled with uncertain, surprising, and life-altering events. And that's actually normal. That's the norm. And in the midst of this, we're invited to keep watch for the presence of the God that we love and know. We learn to recognize God as followers of Jesus through the story of his life. And it's not easy, especially when the uncertainty turns into tragedy. But that was as true for the hearers of Matthew's gospel as it is for us today. People get caught up, though, in trying to avoid tragedy. And they try to avoid tragedy by shoring themselves up with false certainty. And we end up forgetting, as we're busy doing all that, to look around for widows and orphans, you know, people in need. When we're so busy shoring ourselves up with false certainty, we don't share what we have with the hungry. We don't show up even at the airport to pick up refugees. We worry instead that there won't be enough for us, or worse, that saving ourselves is actually the point. And I know that can be confusing, okay? I don't want to be flippant about this, because it's confusing like this. It's like when you're on the airplane and you're a parent, or you're sitting next to an unaccompanied minor, and they say, put on your oxygen mask first. And if you're anything like me, you're like, no way. Are you serious? Because I want my baby to have all of the oxygen. If we're going down, they are going to live, right? But the point is, the baby can't figure out how to work that stupid mask. I know how it works. You know how it works. We do have to breathe for ourselves as we save those around us. And that's why it can get confusing. And Matthew was trying to get his people's attention and remind them, you know, put on your oxygen mask, stay on track, watch. Because if Jesus didn't know when the Lord was going to return, they sure didn't know either. Sometimes we have to wait a while and see where God is at work. And that can be lonely and painful, boring, hard. Yet the testimony of Scripture is that God reliably meets us at our point of greatest need and accompanies us even and especially in the most difficult of circumstances. Gregory Porter's life is a witness to that truth. He is a man who, when you see him, has the build for football. He was good at football. He was so good at football, he received a full scholarship out of high school to San Diego State University. He was a lineman, no surprise. He was planning then to become a professional football player until he got injured, and all of that ruined his dream in his junior year. He says, "I still have the scars. If your shoulder doesn't stay in the socket when you run, then you cannot play football," turns out. He never considered anything else. He certainly never considered being a professional musician. He told his mother in her last days not to worry about him. He was going to be a city planner. He was trying to figure it out. He was 21. She said, "Don't forget the music, Gregory. It's the best thing you do." And 2 days later, she died. Now most shots of him look like this. Can we see that other one? Yeah. That's one. That's Julian, who sings here sometimes. And Julian is not short, I just want to say. That's at the Monterey Jazz Festival. He's a huge man dressed in a tailored sports jacket, wearing the cap that has made him famous. It's becoming a trademark. And this black Kangol is a wraparound he only takes off at night. It's just for style, he says. He put it on after surgery, and he's decided not to take it off. And everybody wonders. It's good to have a little mystery. You have to wait for it. It's just my thing. Gregory was born here in Sacramento. And he grew up in Southern California, Los Angeles, and Bakersfield. And he said that those were dangerous times for him. There was a lot of tension based on our being black family in a pretty much all-white neighborhood. And when I was a young boy, people would urinate into beer bottles and throw them through the windows of our home. One terrifying night, he said, he saw a huge cross burning just outside his bedroom window. He said of that night, "I was terrified. But my mother was great. She was in our faces, letting us know, 'You are valuable, you are worthy, there is nobody above you,'" as the cross burned on the lawn. See, Gregory Porter's mom was a preacher whose faith kept her bold and fearless. In an interview, he said this about her: "She would bring people off the streets and the alleys into our home. There was a little boy one time who didn't have clothes for his first day of school. My mother took the clothes that I had picked out for myself that I had laying on the bed and gave them to him. And I was traumatized and I said, 'That's mine.' And he cried and cried," he said. But as he tells the story to the interviewer now, he's smiling. And he says, "She told me I would understand it one day. She was teaching me." And now her son, Gregory Porter, informs all of our journey with his music, which brings us up, I think, short a little bit when you listen to those words. "Well, they build their houses in preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing, and they'll be surprised when they hear him say, 'Take me to the alley.'" We are surprised because so many of us get lost. We lose our way. We're no longer alert to the needs of our neighbors. One theologian I read this week said it this way: "The present moment is just too slippery for most of us to hang on to. As hard as we try, we tend to slip off into what happened yesterday, or what we have to do an hour from now, or whether our problem is preoccupation with the future or disillusionment with the past. The result is that very few of us live our lives while they are actually happening to us. We're cut off from the present moment, and God cannot get through to us all those layers we put up of regret and expectation. We swaddle ourselves in that." After his mom's death, Gregory moved to be with his brother. He couldn't sing for a long time, over a year. He said just to get out of bed, he started going to a jazz session and watched some musicians. Pretty soon, after attending once or twice, he found himself, he said, there 3 times a week to escape his grief over having no future as an athlete, no real plan beyond that, and losing his mom. But going 3 times a week to a jam session meant he started becoming part of a community. And then slowly, they invited him, and he began to find his voice. But here's the deal. It wasn't until he was 39 years old. That all happened when he was 21. That he released his very first album. That's a lot of waiting. It's not easy. Waiting is never easy. Not for the early followers of Jesus, not for Gregory Porter, and certainly not for us either. But maybe that's why we're all here. Maybe like Gregory Porter, there is a way in which we show up here to find our voice. Or maybe you found your voice, but you're ready to start creating some music. See, because that's what we try to do. We try to gather to encourage each other and help each other to see God in all times, but especially during uncertain and difficult ones. If you're having difficulty recognizing God right now, you're not alone. You can just look around this room for starters. There's a place for us all here. The only requirement right now in this season, I think, is that we try to notice. And I think people are noticing. Out of everything in this whole room, what they noticed was the bra, right? Right. Right. Think about that for a minute. There's boxers up there. Nobody talked about those. Just think about it. See, Advent invites us to look around in multiple directions, back to the birth and ahead to God's second coming, so that we remember to watch for signs of God's arrival now, today. And that's the invitation for us today and in this season. And I believe that we are already blessed because of where we are doing our waiting. We are blessed to be in a world that desperately needs God's love. We have the privilege of waiting in a world that deeply longs for love to transform our institutions into systems that are just and equitable for all of God's beloved children. Or we can rush on towards Christmas. But the invitation is to slow down and to watch for signs of God being born in our lives. We can pretend that life is certain, or we can acknowledge that our present day is actually characterized by uncertainty just as much as it was in Jesus' day. And I don't know about you, but I am often confused and perplexed by this. I hope I don't come across as an expert, because I'm not. Being a follower of Jesus doesn't change that. But it does invite me and all of us to share my confusion and wondering with our community, so that then I'm not so afraid. I get scared. Then I'm not so lonely. I get lonely sometimes. And I think when I share these things out loud, maybe for you too, I'm more apt to seek solutions that are grounded in my hope for God's justice and peace on earth instead of how I can quickly solve something very efficiently. I'm not that efficient. We know that. In this way, even when I am uncertain, I realize I still have a choice. And so do all of us. We can join the build team for Habitat, right? Some of us have already done that. Not to make yourself feel good, but so people actually have a house to live in. I can learn to make coffee for those who come here on Sunday morning, because believe it or not, people, that coffee in the sanctuary thing is groundbreaking for a lot of people. It's huge. I can choose to write that letter I've been composing in my mind, asking for forgiveness from someone that I know I have wounded, or a thank you note to express my gratitude, or challenge my representative to speak up for justice, to stand for what is right. I can take the time to do that. I can choose to live as though I am as ready as I can be, always to be taken to the alley. And then, if I do, and if we do together, as one famous preacher says better than I can, maybe then we will be actually the first generation who finally witnesses this dramatic second coming of Jesus event. Or maybe we'll be more like those who have gone before us, like the Ruth Porters, who met Jesus when she closed her eyes for the last time, like my friend Susan. Either way, though, big event, closing your eyes, either way, we're in God's hands. And God gives us the freedom to make that choice. Wait for it. Together.
Day spring, come in your wisdom. Save us from ourselves. Jesus, come in your weakness. Bring hope to all.